Tim Goldstein, autistic adult, and your host for Life in a Neurotypical Universe, where we take a look at life from the perspective of an autistic adult. Hello, everybody. I'd like to introduce you to our guest today, Cornell Woodson. And Cornell is a diversity person, and
I like that.
Well, the terms have varied so much that I really never know which quite term to use, other than it's certainly diversity.
Right, exactly.
And Cornell has an extensive background in both the corporate world and in the academic world.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I would call myself a diversity consultant, right? Because I sort of help organizations and just people navigate diversity and inclusion and equity issues, right? And how to make organizations better and better for more people. I've been doing this for over 10 years. Corporate and in tech is new to me. Most of my career has been in education and in higher education in particular. So I worked in higher ed, worked at NYU, UVM, and Cornell University, and managed, diversity initiatives in that realm, and then kind of said, you know what, I want to try this out in tech and see how this goes, and kind of pivoted over into this area and like it a lot. You know, there's a lot of similarities, but also a lot of differences, and I'm learning a lot, and it's really stretching my diversity muscle in terms of how I engage with folks in the conversation about the topic.
So what have you seen as being really the difference between them? What do you have to do different to engage in the corporate world that you didn't in the academic world?
One big change is that people in higher ed will sit through a 3-hour workshop. In tech, not so much. An hour and a half is stretching, right? If it's not an hour, they're like, okay. So I think that's one big difference. You have more time to kind of get through material and kind of engage folks in conversation and hear everything's so like on. And so you got to get in where you can. I think the other thing is oftentimes the language, right? That people in higher ed are at least familiar with a lot of the terminology. And in tech, it's very like, huh? What do you mean by equity? And it's like, oh, wow, okay. So almost like we're going back to the very, very basics before we can get to some of the more complex things. So it's like those are the two differences that I've known. There are more, but those are the two that are most prominent for sure. And then also the whole quarter system, right? In higher ed, at least on the East Coast, it's very much by semester, and I don't have to worry about it being the third quarter and that we do a program in the middle of the quarter. Here, you're like very strategic about like when the program happens, or you're not going to get anybody to attend. In higher ed, you're always, unless it's not, you know, during opening, season of a semester or a closing, you're pretty much good.
Interesting. One of the things that I definitely wanted to talk to you about was, when you first, we start working together, knowing each other.
Yeah.
We had talked a little bit about diversity and neurodiversity, mm-hmm. which, you had said that you've certainly heard the term, but yeah. hadn't had the opportunity to be around people and actually learn about it.
Yeah.
Now that you've learned about it, mm-hmm. which you've learned in a number of different ways, including putting on a seminar and bringing in somebody to conduct it,
Absolutely.
And panel talks and such, how would you compare neurodiversity in the diversity world?
Compare it to what?
I guess, to me, I think the analogy, and you can tell me whether it works or not, mm-hmm. I think it has a lot of analogy to the gay community.
Okay.
From the standpoint that it cuts across all normal boundaries. It mm-hmm. doesn't matter male, female, white, black, Chinese, mm-hmm. American, mm-hmm. Russian. It plain don't matter.
Right.
Anyone you can end up being, gay, you can end up being neurodiverse. Mm-hmm, it doesn't mm-hmm. matter from any group.
Very intersectional, right?
Exactly.
It can touch so many different things. And I think the same thing with mental health too, right? Like mental health is also another component that touches all, and even class, right? People might argue that class might be a little bit different, but given the American system.
They just cover it up better is all.
I don't think they have the problem. Yes, I mean, there definitely are some similarities to other groups and also some very stark differences too between those groups, but definitely similarities in terms of like, you can be a person of color or a woman or a trans person and be neurodiverse and things of that sort.
Just mentioning actually trans, it's very interesting. I've read a number of statistics recently mm-hmm. and even in my personal experience, it's just been recently, I've had a number of trans people show up at things I've done.
Right.
And what the statistics seem to be saying is
there is a higher percentage of trans in neurodiversity than there are out of any of the other LGBT groups.
Interesting. Okay. I didn't know that.
Don't know why.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Which, again, makes it a little more intersectional.
Absolutely.
To me, I've got this concept, we'll say.
Okay.
You know, one of the issues with people who are neurodiverse is they tend to have, you know, diminished social skills.
Okay.
You know, not that they're not nice people, but they just say things straight up and, right. you know, some people take objection to that.
Right.
And because of those reduced social skills, the neurodiverse community has not done a very good job of pulling together and coordinating, right. which I think you've already seen in your brief chances of...
Yes.
it's a bunch of, how could you say, arrogant, think we know everything people, and what I know is right, but what somebody else knows
that
is wrong.
That hasn't been my experience. The neurodiverse people I have run into have been very humble and very open to conversation, but I hear you, yes.
it's not uncommon. I mean, it does kind of go with the personality type of, no, I have the right answer. It isn't your answer. It's my answer. Mm-hmm. When you combine in the fact that they don't have the theory of mind, so they can't put yourself in your shoes.
Right.
To me, what I think has happened in the neurodiversity community is because we've had the lack of ability to form that social community, that identifiable community.
Right.
I mean, when you think about the neurodiverse community, you didn't go out and find a community. You had to hunt for people here, there, everywhere. We don't community. That's part of
scientists. Yeah.
And it seems to me that the gay culture, the LGBT culture, one of the things that's allowed them to get the recognition that they have and deserve is the fact that they coordinated and cooperated for the most part phenomenally well.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're definitely seeing on the other side, no, it's not a lot of coordination. There's lots of individual efforts that are doing a lot of great things, but would have a lot better effect if they work together.
Absolutely.
What would you say as just recommendations to people who are involved in the neurodiverse community of reflecting on the, you know, LGBT community that you also work with? What lessons should we take out of it? Because they've done a phenomenal job, and there's a lot of parallel between the two.
Absolutely. You know, for me, as someone who doesn't identify as neurodiverse, it's hard for me to tell another group, like, here's what you should be doing, right? Because, like, you have to determine that for yourself about what works best. Since you're asking me, I will answer this question.
Right. The question is less of tell us exactly what to do than... Right. We just are clueless, and give us a little bit of the list of different things that have worked.
Right? Exactly.
So we can decide, is it appropriate, is it not appropriate?
Exactly. I think for me, it's really figuring out the diversity even within the neurodiversity community, right? Because there are so many different ways in which being neurodiverse impacts different people. So I would say working within first to figure out what are the needs of the broader community, and then figuring out how to organize and to package that message to different organizations and different things that sort to educate folks on what the needs of neurodiverse people are and start building up that allyship base of people who can also help spread that word. So I think getting together to sort of get to know each other, to understand the different ways in which people are impacted in their workplaces or just in the world, right? Going to the grocery store taking it in and learning about that really informs, okay, so what's the next step? What do we organize around so that we are not taking on so much at once, but getting at the things that are really most impactful, right? So we know that in the LGBTQ community that many of our LGBTQ members end up homeless because they're kicked out of their homes when they're teenagers and, you know, things that sort. So, you know, homelessness is a big issue that the community takes up. What are the big issues within the neurodiverse community that really need to be, not that all of them aren't important, but what are the ones that are really, really detrimental to the community survival?
And you're right. It's a very segmented community. You know, when you take the homelessness part, which is actually the statistics again say more and more homeless are being diagnosed as being autistic. So not only they were outcasts from whatever group anyways,
right.
they maybe then didn't have good social skills, so they couldn't get jobs, they couldn't maintain jobs,
right.
and they end up on the street.
Absolutely.
So again, a lot of crossover parallels.
Yes.
but I like that idea. Essentially get ourselves together to work together with each other.
And to know each other.
Yeah, and then worry about moving out to the broader community.
And I think that's the big thing that not even just the LGBTQ community, but the Black community, the Latino community, women, like they know what the issues are that impact them most. And then they organize around those particular issues to begin educating, addressing them, and pushing, right? And really challenging people to say, look, this is an issue. You need to notice it. You need to see it. And here's what we need. You know, that's, which is why I like about Carrie Kelly that we had her here yesterday at Looker, that she had this kind of like, here are the five things that you can do to support and work well with neurodiverse people. I'm finding that's the other thing that I'm noticing is the difference between higher ed and tech is that higher ed, we love our long, lengthy articles, right? Tech is like, give me the five things I need to do right now, right? That kind of BuzzFeed style model of like the top five things you can do today. I think that's what people are looking for. People want to do something. They just don't know what it is.
You know, it's funny with Carrie's tip sheets. Uh-huh. She and I had met for dinner the night before.
Yeah, yeah,
I
she mean, told
we,
me.
We've known each other for a little while, yeah, right. And we've done events and such together. Yeah. So we got together for dinner because it's always just a fun chat.
Uh-huh.
And it's always an interesting discussion because she is probably more technical, we'll say,
okay,
than I tend to be.
Okay,
I tend to generalize more.
Okay,
Because it fits a wider range. You know, mm-hmm. You figure out where you fit in the generality.
Gotcha.
She wants to have the exact details. So it's funny when you say that hers are more condensed.
Uh-huh.
No, I take them a whole nother step and I condense them further. And when she discusses it, when she and I were discussing one,
right.
It was funny as heck because she didn't feel there was enough detail that she could really understand what I was trying to express.
Mm.
And it's a tip sheet that I've handed out to probably 300 different people.
And I've
people.
Seen your tip sheet, yes,
and,
exactly.
And everybody goes, wow, you know, I can do something with this.
Absolutely.
But I think it really shows the difference between somebody who, I mean, and Carrie is a very good communicator.
Absolutely.
So we're not talking about somebody who is on the autism spectrum that has a challenge communicating
right,
at all.
Right. She's just does it differently.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was just very interesting when having that conversation of seeing how different she sees it.
Yeah.
She almost has to reduce it down to her physics model,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Where I'm willing to say from the 10,000 foot level, it kind of looks about like acting like a tribe.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Without the rules of what a tribe is. Because most people have the clue of what a tribe is,
yeah. I feel. And what I love about that, right, is that both of your approaches to educating folks, right, there are some who are going to respond really well to your level of communication, and then there are some that are going to learn really well from hers. And I think that's another piece of advice or thought that I would give to is that, you know, particularly, you know, for example, in my work in diversity overall, there are a lot of ways to approach the work, and that there doesn't need to be a one-size-fits-all approach to it, that if everyone's doing something and communicating and educating, we're rippling enough, you know, that ripple effect of impact can be had if everyone's doing what they're good at and doing it in a way that works for them.
So align on what the goal to accomplish is.
Absolutely.
But leave it up to the individual to be who they are to deliver the message and the way they deliver.
Exactly, right? As long as they're, that you know, I find as long as we are representing the issues authentically, I think that is really important. And I think overall, we all need to be better at that, at being a little bit more open, that just because my style isn't yours, and I'm not saying you're saying this, but I've dealt with this personally, that because my style isn't like other people's style, that it's like, oh, you're not really doing the work. You're weak on it, right? It's like, no, I just do it differently, and I attract different people that you may not be able to attract.
Well, you know, I would say I know a fair number of people in the DE&I space.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, a lot of intersection going on.
Absolutely,
there.
Absolutely.
And yeah, you definitely have more of a bring a high energy, mm-hmm. Feel comfortable approach to it.
Absolutely.
As opposed to the more traditional, this is the way it is, these are the rules, this is
right.
What you do.
And we do get there, right? So for me, I'm very much interested in the psychology around how people respond to difference and this information of ways in which they help perpetuate systems that they don't even know exist. Right. And so what I know is that when I'm being approached about some way in which I've helped perpetuate the discrimination against a group, my first defense is to be like, whoa, hold on. Right. And so I want people to feel comfortable so I can take them to the challenging point. I find that when people trust me, they're more willing to go to conversations about privilege and about oppression and discrimination, because it's like, I'm not out to get you. I'm not out to harm you and take away your nice things. I just want you to see the world as it is, right? And that may not be your world, but it is the world of how other people experience it. So yeah.
I think you nailed a super important point right there,
mm-hmm.
Which applies to everybody in the world.
Yeah.
And what that is, it doesn't matter if that's your reality. If it's my reality, you've got to at least respect that to me, exactly. That's what reality is.
Exactly. And that it's true because I said it is.
Yeah, and you don't have to agree with it. You just exactly. have to you know, at least acknowledge that, yes, that's your reality. I accept that. Would you mind hearing my reality?
Absolutely. And I feel like, you know, people just aren't there yet. People don't know how to do that. I think they think, you know, you take gay marriage, for example, right? When we were fighting for gay marriage, everyone's like, but I don't want gay marriage. You don't have to, you ain't got to get gay married. Right. No one says that if you're straight, that now all of a sudden you got to go marry a man now. Like, no one has said that. We're just saying, mind your business and let me do my life the way I need to live my life, right? Like,
right.
Mind yours and I'll mind mine and we'll be happy.
That's exactly it. Just let me do what I want to do. It doesn't affect anybody else, doesn't impact
exactly.
anybody else.
Exactly.
You know, what's the difference if I like, you know, chocolate ice cream and you like vanilla ice cream? I
mean, it does not prevent you from doing what you like. I'm just saying, I want you to let me live. And that's one of the things, again, it's just that psychology around this conversation. I'm like, why is it that you respond that way when someone brings up someone else's lived experience? What is it that you're hearing in your head? I remember the time I was in grad school and one of my colleagues in grad school, you know, called me out for my male privilege. And I was like, excuse me? And I was so upset. How dare you challenge my right to be here? I mean, this is what I said verbatim. I can speak if I want to speak. I worked hard to get here and da-da-da-da. And she's looking at me like, I didn't say any of that. I never said you didn't work hard. And I remember telling her, I'm black, gay, and broke. What you mean, male privilege, right? But I had only lived in my marginalized identities, right? Those are the things that are usually most salient to us, the areas where we struggle. But she never said that I didn't struggle. She never said any of those things. She just said that there are some things that you don't have to think about because you are a man, even though you're black and gay. And at the time I was broke, I'm not anymore, but right. You don't have to think about as a woman sitting in the classroom and whether or not my voice matters or not. And so it's just interesting how I heard one thing, but she was saying something totally different. And it was at that point, I was like, wow, I wonder what other people are hearing when they hear white privilege and, you know, things of that sort.
Yeah, I mean, she made a statement that was a factual statement.
Exactly.
I mean, you're male. We're in a society where
that
males do have privileges.
Exactly.
I mean, so she wasn't saying that it was you personally or anything.
But I wrote a whole nother chapter that I thought she was saying, and but where did it come from, right?
Right.
Where did it come from? And I would argue in my experience of over 10 years of doing this work that other people hear the exact same thing when they hear that word privilege, that you're assuming that I got here without hard work. And I work hard to debunk that, to get people to go, oh, okay, I'm not denying your narrative of struggle, but I am asking you to consider this area where you have never struggled and probably never will.
You know, I think that whole idea of privilege is probably the wrong term that should be used.
Okay.
Because I think it is misleading.
Okay.
It's almost saying as if you were given the silver spoon and life was just wonderful for you.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, you know, I'm a straight white guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I guess I'm supposed to have more privilege than you have, according to, you know, the rules of God
right.
knows what.
Not that you should, but you do.
Right.
And not because anything that you've done, because that
no, just because
sees you.
That's who I was born as.
Right. Exactly. I always tell people when I do work, so I'm like, you know, as a man, I wasn't. Wherever you believe babies come from, whether it's, you know, God or the earth or the tree, right? I wasn't somewhere saying, yo, send me down to earth with the following stuff, right? Don't make me a woman because I know what y'all do to women down there, right? I didn't ask for this stuff. I just was minding my business, right? And the stork brought me to my parents and this is what I got, right? But then I still do have a responsibility to be mindful of how the world sees me and then use that privilege for good. I want to get to your point about the word privilege. To me, it's not the word. Is how people educate people about the word. So to me, it's always a user issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember back in the day where people were like, well, PowerPoint ruins presentations. No, it's not PowerPoint. It's not the tool.
No, it's bad PowerPoint presentations
right?
that ruin it.
It's how people use it, right? And people do tend to use privilege to erase that, oh, you don't know what struggle is like because you're white. And it's like, that's not true, right? We have poor white folks who grew up, you know, in destitute situations. But you put them side by side to a poor black person, and there is some level of privilege there that
right.
is different that I'll never see.
Right.
So to me, it's about the user of that language and not so much the word.
Mm.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah.
You know, the bad part is, of course, you can't control the listeners, how they're going to apply
you
it.
You cannot.
So I think that's where, to me, if we could find a better terminology,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what, you know, it's not coming to me at the moment.
Right.
But there seems to, like, there should be some kind of terminology that says, You know, both of us as males mm-hmm. have greater opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's the way to put it, is opportunity.
Right, but it's still privilege.
Yeah, but the difference is privilege comes across to me as saying, silver spoon, you didn't have to do anything. Opportunity says, mm-hmm. yeah, you got the opportunity, but you still had to work it.
Yeah.
Which kind of takes in what you're saying of you still had to work hard. Just
I think for me, so let's say we went to a conference and we all voted that that was the way we were going to explain it. In 20 years, we'd have a problem with that phrase, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's going to change.
Right? And so, like, for me, it's not about changing the language. It's about one, me as a man being open and or white people or cisgendered people or you name it, right? Being open-minded enough to dig a little bit deeper to really making sure that they're understanding it the way it needs to be understood versus running with their assumption of, like, this is what I think you're saying and I'm running with that and now I'm pissed and I'm never listening again. But then also the people using the language to really make sure that I don't just throw that language out at you, but I have a follow-up of, and here's what I mean by that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think that we've taught people effective communication of how to, one, come with an open heart and open mind and ask questions, and how to make sure that my message is actually getting across. That's the breakdown.
Right.
We've changed. I mean, you know, when you think about D&I, it wasn't always D&I. It was just diversity.
It was D.
And then we decided, you know, it was like, okay, that's not enough anymore, okay? Then it was inclusion. And then it was like, yeah, no, that's not enough. And so every time something changes and we can't keep changing the word because people aren't doing justice by it, we've got to fix how we do justice by the word.
Well, this probably kicks in a little bit of the neurodiversity side. Uh-huh. You know, especially the Asperger kind of mm-hmm. Neurodiversity, we have a tendency to take definitions yeah. by the first dictionary definition uh-huh. and not listen to necessarily the rest of it. So
right.
To me, it probably has more... I hang on it tighter because of what the definition of the word is.
Right.
Not
right.
that in the general use, you're not 100% correct.
And so from your perspective as a neurodiverse person, if you were in my workshop and I talked about privilege, but then I followed up with a working definition, would that be a strategy to help you go, okay, now I have what he means by that when he's using it?
Well, I think when you just said right today, mm-hmm. as we've been talking, that no, you had privilege, but that didn't mean you didn't have to work your butt off.
Right, right.
And
right.
I think that's the part that to me is missing, is that follow-up of saying,
I agree.
No, it wasn't gifted to you. Yes, you did have some help up the ladder, right. but you still had to climb by yourself.
Absolutely, and exactly. And that's why I'm so adamant about not just throwing that jargon out there. There's got to be some, and let's unpack it. Let's talk about what that actually means and what it looks like. And I've had a lot of success, particularly with white, straight, cisgendered, Christian Catholic men who otherwise, I've had so many white men who come to me at their workshop and go, I hate diversity trainings, but this was good. I felt both supported, but I also felt pushed and challenged. And to me, that's a great happy medium, that mix of support and challenge of like, I'm going to support you, I'm going to validate you, I'm going to be here with you, but I'm also going to really push you out off the edge to get you to really see some stuff that's ugly so we can walk you through that ugly process of understanding the ways in which the world is navigated by other people that are not you. You
know? Well, I didn't know all the tricks you used on us, but I have to say they've been very, very effective.
I think so, too.
Didn't realize it.
But, I think so, too, right? I got all my magic.
What, you know, talking about, again, neurodiversity and now that you're played in the corporate world a bunch, mm-hmm. what have you seen, just from your current understanding of neurodiversity in the corporate world? What do you see as far as the challenges? And what do you see as far as potential ways to overcome some of those challenges?
Yeah, the challenges I've seen is a lack of awareness of it, right? A lack of awareness of what neurodiversity means, what it is, what it looks like, and then how to support folks who are. And that was really one of the big catalysts for why I wanted to do programming around it here at Looker was because I wanted people to become more aware about it, that there are neurodiverse people in our midst who may not know themselves that they are neurodiverse or may know but don't want to tell you because of what, out of fear that you may not treat them right. And we've got, if we're going to be the type of organization or the type of society that really sees people for what they bring to the table, we've got to understand the multiple ways in which people show up, and neurodiversity is one of those things. And so I think that challenge for me is the lack of awareness and the lack of what to do with that awareness once I have it. How do I support folks, and how do I work with folks and not run with my assumption about when you respond to me in a certain way that I run with it and go, you're insubordinate, versus like, okay, this is a different way of thinking, a different way of navigating. How do I shift my managerial style to support you so we get to the same result? I think some of the, what was the word that you used? Some of the opportunity that I see there.
A greater opportunity.
That I think there's interest. I think people want to know, but just haven't had someone who kind of delivers them the information on a platter, right? Like that's essentially what you have to do. You got to deliver information to people on a platter so that they don't have to work too hard for it to find it. So I think the opportunity that people are hungry for, they do want to know, they do want to learn, and that we have the opportunity to do that, that people are open about it.
Well, you know, we're obviously playing in the tech world here.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the tech world, you know, it's quite well known that autistic people tend to cluster into more logical, left brain type software engineering,
right.
And lawyers, accountants, and physicians, the bad bedside manner physician.
right. It's funny, by the way, because I'm watching this show called Chicago Med, and one of the surgeons, he is he's autistic, he has Asperger's, and he cannot read emotion.
That's me.
In many of the episodes, he is they put him through therapy. I don't know if that's a thing really, but it was on TV, and they put him through this therapy that helps him become more aware of facial expressions and tone, and he's like learning how to like navigate that. But he has bad side manner. He like one episode a patient died and goes, "Your husband's dead." And I was like, what the hell? And it's like, and so the other doctor who knows that he is, you know, neurodiverse goes, so what he's saying is that, right, that we're sorry that your, you know, husband has passed away. We're here for, right? And the other doctor's like, what did I do? And so it was just interesting seeing that after, you know, talking to you and meeting with you and being introduced to the concept of neurodiversity and then seeing that on the show. I go, oh my goodness. That's like, it's been wild to learn a lot. Sorry.
That is wonderful. And I think, you know, what it's done is it's opened your eyes up. That little bit of awareness has opened your eyes now that there's a big, huge world out there.
Absolutely.
You know, I would say with what you know in the tech world that you've worked with, how many neurodiverse people do you think you've run into?
Oh, tons. But that's another thing that I had to be careful. Because, like, once you have this information, then you start identifying everybody who you think is neurodiverse, right? And that can be dangerous, I think.
On the other hand, if you take Hans Asperger, what Hans said was, once you start to learn the signs of autism, you see it everywhere.
Right. And I think for me, you know, getting away from necessarily labeling someone as neurodiverse or with Asperger's and more of just being noticing the behaviors and being prepared to support and work.
Right. I think the labels are only useful for having a discussion.
Exactly.
But when you're dealing with a person, who cares what the label is? You just need to know that this is a left brain leaning person and they're likely to come out with a verbatim, your husband's dead.
Right, exactly. And then literally, and with a cold face, right? I'm like, wow. And like, and that was the same thing for when I learned more about the transgender community, right? You start learning the definitions, you start understanding the, you know, the experiences, and then people, really well-intentioned people, start going, oh, okay, so they're trans, because that's what fit, right? That's what I was told trans was. And it's like, no. We don't need to start labeling people. You need to be prepared for how you support folks, you know, when you know that they are, or, you know, things of that sort. So it's, to me, it's the same thing.
Exact same thing, right.
When
you throw the label on it, suddenly you're trying to make them be a specific type of person.
Exactly.
Instead of saying, they're kind of in that field, so I need to deal that way with
exactly.
That
I recognize that one behavior, and I think I know how to manage this and work with them, but I don't need to label their whole existence unless they've done that themselves, right?
Exactly.
And I think that that's our mind's need to put things into comfy, clear boxes, right? I need to know what you are. I need to know how to identify you. And if I can't identify you, I'm pissed off and I'm annoyed by it.
You know, I had a mentor that I worked with one time, and he was talking about business cards and putting, you know, the titles on business cards.
Yeah.
And it tends to be that a lot of small entrepreneurs and such use these flippy, crazy, weird, you know, type titles. And what he was saying was, that's actually hurting you.
Gotcha, yeah.
Because it's hurting you because people can't figure out where to place you in their head. Exactly what you're saying.
Right.
They can't figure out the category.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Cornell had to step out for just a moment to call his dog walker and make sure that they arrived on time to let his dog out.
Had to hire a dog walker today.
Well, you know, I say talk about privilege when you go hire a dog walker.
I mean, right? It's a whole nother level of privilege, Tim. Like, coming into tech, that's the biggest difference between higher ed and tech is the salary, for sure. And having, like, the access to be able to do that, to have a dog, to be able to afford a dog, first of all, is big. But yeah, I had to hire a dog walker, and now she's there, so that's perfect. Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem whatsoever. I mean, I would appreciate that you're taking the time out of a busy day.
I love talking to you. We always have such a great conversation, and I've learned so much from you about this particular topic in general, so I just really appreciate
you. I've learned a lot just about the whole DE&I thing from you, so it's been a mutually beneficial approach.
Yes.
What would you recommend for somebody, let's say, in the corporate world, because that's the world I happen to know.
Yeah,
at least.
Right.
If somebody in the corporate world, company, whatever, was trying to understand more about neurodiversity and how to, essentially, you're right, the awareness piece is the biggest thing.
Absolutely.
If you don't recognize a group exists, how do you even know what?
Absolutely.
You don't know what to do because you don't know if you're talking to one.
That's such a great question. I think for me, it's about being open to difference. I think that when people walk through the world acknowledging and understanding that people are different, then your mind and your eyes are already open to looking for it, right? And so you start noticing like, that's a different way of responding to that or to doing that. I wonder what that is. And then being inquisitive and asking questions, right? I noticed that you responded this way to that. Can you tell me more about why? Right? And then I learned, I'm neurodiverse. And here's the, I was like, what is that? Right? And so the more we're more aware that not everyone is the same, and then we're open to learning more about that difference, we unearth a lot of things that we didn't otherwise unearth. I think the other thing is really intentionally putting ourselves in positions to engage with folks who are different than ourselves. We are very much prone to being with people who are similar to us because it's safe and it makes sense. It's comfortable. I'm good, right?
Well, the big problem in the tech world is how do we hire in the tech world?
Exactly.
We hire by fit. What does fit mean? You're like me. That's what fit means.
Exactly. And we utilize referrals a lot because people hire people who are like them. But really being intentional about, no, I'm going to branch out and really engage with folks who are different from my lived experiences really helps become more aware. There was research that showed that college-age students or even students who are younger than college who have spent a lot of time abroad are much more open to difference and learning about difference than students and people who have only lived their lives in one area their entire life, right? Because you're forced to be culturally competent when you're going to different countries. And so I think that we have to practice that every day, either travel a lot or practice that desire to engage with difference intentionally.
I think in the U.S. that's more prevalent than maybe in other countries because in the U.S. we tend not to travel out of the U.S.
because
it's so darn big.
And when you're in the EU and everything like that, you can pop around to Bulgaria and Belize and all kinds of places because you have all that there. So
right,
absolutely.
And that's no different than going from New York City down to Florida. It's
right.
Like no big deal. You drive that. But,
exactly. But people have to be intentional. So if people are interested, they know about neurodiversity but don't know a lot about it, ask questions. If you've never heard this before, ask questions. But also be open to the difference that is around you and utilizing the people who exist right there to ask them about their experiences with their identity and who they are.
Oh, wonderful. Well, we're running short on time because we're both busy. Yeah. But if somebody wanted to reach out to you as a consultant and bring you in, how would they reach you?
Absolutely. You can reach me at Cornell, Cornell, at bravetrainings.com. I also have bravetrainings.com as my consultant, the website. And reach out to me there, and I'd love to engage and chat and talk.
Perfect. I will put those down into the show notes as I get this all edited up.
Thank you.
And we'll get this out the door.
I'm planning a wedding, so I gotta get the gigs.
Yeah, man, exactly, because, weddings ain't cheap these days.
They are not cheap. I was a wedding planner for 8 years. They are not cheap.
Oh, when you're planning that long, it's going to be really expensive.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
But so much appreciate you taking
your time out of
a super, super busy day.
I really appreciate that. Awesome. Na, na,
na. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Life in a Neurotypical Universe. If you want to learn more about neurodiversity or ask questions, you can head to my website, timgoldstein.com.
and be glad to help you out. Find your way through the neurodiverse universe.